to best advantage. As he did, he picked off his enemies two by two. In less than a minute, he'd eliminated both platoons. 17 vehicles down, more than 50 to go. Straker imagined what his enemies would do next. They had to be surprised and concerned that one opponent had already wiped out so many of their combatants. In their place, he'd take no chances. He'd turn his entire force and try to surround and trap the mech suitor before tackling further defenses. Reversing course, Straker ran back the way he came, slipping out of the trap as the opters tried to extend and encircle. As he did, he picked off three more cars and two more tanks and ducked back among the rock formations. 22 down. He became aware of activity above him, close above him, not the main space battle taking place kilometers higher. He sent out an air defense radar pulse and identified 2 6-ship hexes of the largest enemy fighters, the ones that approached attack ships in size. Unlike the smaller drones, these had weapons that might severely damage or destroy him in one shot. Those blasts started falling all around him, blowing rock into the sky and shaking the ground. He worked himself deeper into a small canyon and narrowed the arc where they could reach him. Glancing beam shots fell hot on his skin, but his field reinforcement and his superconducting layers shrugged off the heat. For now. Okay, they'd called in air support? Well, he had some on-call air support of his own. "Straker to Trinity," he said. "I need you to clear my skies. Can you pop over here?" "Aye, aye, sir," came Zaxby's voice. A moment later, Trinity exploded into existence from underspace, emerging for no more than 2 seconds. In that time, 12 hard-driven secondary beams skewered the 12 attack fighters, leaving them tumbling and falling to crash into the surface. Before the first one had augured in, Trinity had disappeared again, and Straker marveled at what an AI-controlled warship could do. Her triple brain made Straker and his mech suit look slow. He shivered with the passing thought that perhaps it was a blessing all AIs before Indy went mad. If they hadn't, they might have transformed or even replaced humanity in ways he wasn't sure he'd like. Perhaps they still would if Indy could be reliably replicated. But until then, the universe belonged to organic life, and organics fought over territory. That meant at least this little corner of the galaxy would remain comprehensible. Before the dust of the crashes settled, Straker raced at his enemies, using the confusion to shield him from their sensors. Disrupting unit cohesion was another specialty of mech suitors, although he admitted that didn't work on these opters as well as it did on human troops. Even more so than Hawk, the insectoids kept calm and fearlessly executed their plans. They could be surprised, but it didn't seem their morale could be broken. They probably had very little individual sense of self-preservation. At least, the servant creatures of the queens didn't. Probably any being as intelligent as a queen would value itself quite highly. He filed away that thought for later. Inside the smoke and dust, he rampaged through them, killing whatever he targeted. Compared to their relatively basic combat vehicles, his mech suit had sensors which were the height of sophistication. If this had been an armored Hawk battalion, he'd be constantly pinpointed by his own multispectral emissions, his radar and LIDAR. But these opters didn't seem to have high-end detectors. For now, he was a wolf. No, a tiger among sheep. He didn't keep conscious count, but his SAI tallied his kills at 55 before the enemy broke. Even then, they didn't really rout. They merely withdrew as rapidly as possible, back the way they came, presumably to their dropships, attempting to preserve some forces. Straker activated his comlink to Red Wolf.
"Sitrep, I've joined the defense forces, sir. They're pretty thin, but we fought off a battalion of those combat cars and tanks, and we don't see any more of them."
"I think I've driven another battalion off," said Straker.
"Alone? You see Loco around here anywhere?"
"Hot shit, sir."
"Thanks. Trinity helped, and these opters aren't nearly as deadly as Hawk in ground mode. Any other attacks to your perimeter?"
Red Wolf conferred with someone for a moment.
"No, sir, but the monitor above us is in bad shape. Commodore Gray better get here soon or we'll be overwhelmed. Tell your new buddies relief is on its way. I've already told them that you're out there kicking ass, sir. It really helped morale.
Good. I'm pursuing the ground troops as they withdraw. Maybe I can take out their drop ships or at least gather some intel. Straker out.
He was already bounding low across the surface, keeping a sharp watch above his head with his ADA lasers activated and charged. This took extra power, but the beams, too weak to knock anything down but good enough to blind sensors, were vital to his survival. They fired automatically from time to time as anything came close from above, and now and again he sent a force cannon bolt skyward. If he'd been the Opter commander on the spot, he'd have sent an overwhelming force, say 100 drones, to pound Straker from the air. He suspected that there wasn't really an Opter commander in the human sense, though, not one that could adjust to surprises and give radically different orders. The Opters seemed poor at improvisation, or even at identifying what was important when a queen wasn't around. By contrast, both human empires had tried to incubate a thoroughly competent chain of command, from the lowest corporal through the highest flag officer, so every leader could take over in a pinch. Of course, it was almost certain that the Opters didn't know Derek Straker, the Liberator, occupied the pesky mech suit. If they had, they might have done whatever it took to get him. It wasn't undue pride that made him think so. He knew his value to the liberation movement, if mainly to its spirit and direction. He might have killed a few more of the retreating enemies, especially those slowed by obvious damage, but he chose to observe. He wasn't sure how truly hidden he was, but there was no need to give the Opters help in targeting him, especially if their drop ships had better sensors than their cannon fodder. He peeked between two rocks at the crest of a low ridge to see the vehicles boarding, not the squat, blocky lifters he expected, but heavy fighter drones. It appeared the spacecraft each carried one armored vehicle in a conformal bay. This may have explained the cars and tanks' expendability. They were more in the nature of add-ons than true ground formations, utility vehicles used to seize or destroy certain targets on missions, much as a human ship's marines might perform. Probably only a limited number of the heavy fighters were so equipped. Straker recorded everything, but didn't bother to try to attack. His force cannon wouldn't penetrate the fighter's armor at this distance, while their weapons might take him out with one lucky shot. He tried to open a data link to Trinity. It took half a minute, but eventually he was able to access a read-only feed. From what he could sort out from the blizzard of information, not only was the AI-run ship destroying Opters by the dozen, but she was disrupting them badly with direct hacking attacks. No doubt they would improve their countermeasures later, but for now, there was a bubble around Trinity that no Opter could seem to penetrate. It must be defined by the nanoseconds of light speed within which, if the critters got too close, the AI's hacking could overcome any defenses. Straker chuckled. Cybernetic bug repellent. That's what it was. This went far toward explaining why Trinity and Rhinoceros hadn't been overwhelmed. By standing back to back, as it were, the thick-skinned, armored dinosaur of space and the slashing bird of prey had managed to fend off all comers. This didn't mean they remained pristine. Trinity's system status telltales showed at least half yellow and red. Many of her weapons were down, and her armor, never thick in the first place, had enough holes to fill a Saxon whorehouse. Rhino looked even worse. Parts of her burned with stubborn oxygen fires, and most of her weaponry was gone. What looked like insectoid battle suiters crawled on her surface or entered her skin through rents in her armor. As Straker watched, an explosion gouted plasma into space, perhaps from a mine or bomb set by the Opter Marines. Trinity continued to orbit the monitor, stripping away attackers wherever she could, but she was only one ship, and despite her valiant defense, she was losing the fight. Straker cursed at himself, trying to figure out what he could do. He could use his drop jets to blast out into space, but his mech suit was no fighter. Without cover or maneuverability,
he'd be shot to pieces in short order. "Trinity, how close are Gray's ships?" he asked, desperate for hope and good news.
"They've already begun arriving, but only corvettes in numbers. They've been unable to reach us."
"What about the frigates and destroyers?"
"They're minutes from engagement. Even then, it will take time to fight through."
"If you can hold on for just a little longer..."
"I'm aware of this fact, Admiral Straker. No amount of encouragement or micromanagement on your part will change the situation. You can't do anything to help."
"The hell I can't. Straker out." But Straker had no idea how to make good on his words. He just knew he couldn't sit on his ass and do nothing. He turned his attention back to the opter-heavy fighters retrieving their ground elements. There was one per tank or scout car, and as each vehicle locked into place, the aerospace craft took off. One light tank lagged behind the rest, struggling with damaged tracks. It gave him an idea. He worked his way around the flank to a position directly astern of the grounded fighter, the most likely place it lacked sensor coverage. Then he crept up on it, staying as low as possible, using the rocky terrain for concealment. When the struggling tank got close to its fighter and was turning itself this way and that, trying to line up to enter its small deployment bay, Straker rushed forward. He scooped up a 5-ton boulder on the way and smashed the tank's turret with it from behind, gambling that this would destroy any of its sensors and antennas, and possibly stun the driver. With any luck, from the fighter pilot's point of view, the tank would simply go dark. He had no idea whether the fighter had sensors so close to its skin. Everything he'd seen about these opters suggested rugged simplicity with few extra systems. Their philosophy seemed to be that everything was expendable. This was highly efficient when lives were cheap and numerous. Biologically, much of humanity's instinct to value people came from the steep investment in each human. 20 years or so until adulthood and usefulness to society, with enormous amounts of education for any technical role. Opter drone pilots, on the other hand, probably developed much faster, and, he guessed, needed only enough training to fight and die for their queens. Straker quickly dragged the tank closer to the fighter, hoping this would make it appear as if the vehicle were still trying to get aboard. When it was close, he shoved it into a small depression, and then scooped up rocks and soil to bury it under a shallow layer of surface material. Then he stepped aboard in its place and braced himself in the deployment bay. Would the pilot have sensors inside his bay, or would the creature merely have telltales that told it when the tank was aboard, or perhaps only something simple like pressure detectors in the deck? That tank looked to mass about the same as his mech suit, perhaps 50 tons. And if the pilot wasn't fooled, well, at least he could tear the fighter apart from the inside. Straker waited a long moment, and then another. Finally, the fighter rocked a bit and lifted. Straker watched the ground fall away beneath him. He was braced in the bay, facing outward like a paratrooper in an aircraft's exit door, waiting for the command to jump. The bright stars of space spun across his visual field, clouded by the sparkles of drives and thrusters and weapons fire. Where would the opter fighter go? Would it flee for the nest ships waiting far off? He thought not, not unless they believed they'd lost the battle. No, there were still a few minutes until the trickle of Republic ships became a flood. The opters still had a chance to finish off the Monitor and Trinity and overwhelm the Beta 2 base. His gamble paid off. As he'd hoped, within seconds, the fighter climbed and maneuvered to drop its combat vehicle on the skin of Rhinoceros. Only that combat vehicle was Straker. When he planted his magnetized feet on the armored hull of the Monitor, he sent a force cannon bolt into the fighter's guts in the direction he figured the pilot should be. The hot jet of plasma cut deep, and fires began to burn. Straker placed both gauntlets against the stricken fighter and shoved. He was happy to see it drift and begin to tumble, apparently dead. "Thanks for the ride, bug buddy," he chuckled. The burn of a beam on his skin reminded him how exposed he was out here on the hull. It would be stupid beyond measure to try to fight across the naked plain of the monitor's curving hull, with every fighter in his line of sight and he in theirs. Quickly, he ran for the nearest rent in the armor and dove into the ship's interior. Now he was in his element. Straker began to kill opters. He hunted the bugs through the interior for 5 long hours. It didn't matter that he fought opters in opter battle suits. Battle suits of any kind were simply no match for him. He was a giant among pygmies, with weapons that killed with one shot, one thought. Tanks couldn't have operated inside the monitor, but a mech suit could. Sometimes he had to crouch. Sometimes he ripped through walls. Sometimes he wished his suit was half its size. But always, always, he slaughtered them as he found them. He relieved and then led scattered and demoralized groups of Marines. They accreted around him like lost souls around a savior. He was an angel, the only one that could lead them out of hell. Though weary, they followed him, supported him, guarded his back. Long before they killed the last bug, Commodore Gray's capital ships turned the tide of battle. When it became obvious they would lose, the drone fleets turned as if of one mind and fled, saving as many as they could. Gray's grim warriors, angered at their losses, pursued them, killing all they could, until the Nest ships fled into side space. Gray's flagship, too slow to chase the enemy drones, boarded Rhinoceros with her own Marines. Once his ship was secured, Commodore Pearson landed his sorely wounded monitor on the moon's surface, which allowed base forces and repair vehicles easy access. Straker and the surviving Marines soon stood proudly on top of the enormous ship as if upon a metal hill, surveying the battlefield. Most of the ground turrets, strong points, and facilities of the shipyards remained intact, preserved by the tenacious defense of the heroic monitor crew and Trinity. Fleet ships cruised above in formation, and the moon's landscape swarmed with activity. Away on the horizon, he noticed a similar metal hill, and a line of vehicles heading toward it. He remembered there had been 2 monitors. That must be Hippopotamus, Rhino's fallen sister ship. He silently saluted her hulk for a moment and hoped there were survivors. Commodore Gray comlinked from her flagship.
"Congratulations, Liberator," she said, her voice devoid of its usual faint disapproval. "You managed to hold."
"We managed," he replied. "Thank Trinity and Pearson's people and yours. Everybody fought hard today. Unfortunately, there are plenty of good men and women to add to the roles of our fallen heroes."
"This is a private comlink, Admiral. No need for speeches."
"It's how I feel, Ellen. If it's a speech, okay, I'll own it. Now, what did you call about?"
"I've got someone for you to meet."
"Oh? Who?"
He never could have predicted her answer.
"An opter defector."
Chapter 4 Straker on the surface of Moon Beta 2. Commodore Gray continued her surprising comlink report to Straker about the opter defector.
"He says he wants to talk to you, and you only."
Straker considered for a moment.
"He, huh? It's male?"
"No doubt."
Gray seemed amused by something.
"Send him to Trinity. I'll meet him there. Straker out."
He then called Trinity for pickup. The opter defector was brought aboard in shackles, snug duranium bracelets and anklets linked with chains. A heavy, treaded maintenance robot held a portion of the chain with one metal claw. Straker had expected an insectoid creature, but this looked like an ordinary man, standing there in Trinity's wardroom, unassuming, of average height and build, with dark brown hair and faintly golden skin, well within the norms for the many variations of humanity. Only his eyes seemed unusual, calm and serene, but still sharp, as if they saw everything around him.
Those eyes rested on each being in the room in turn. Nolan, Zaxby, Red Wolf, and then Straker, who sat with a welcome mug of calf in his fist. "Have a seat," said Straker, gesturing. "You want a drink?"
"Anything with caffeine,"
the man said in an ordinary tone. He sat and folded his shackled hands on the table in front of him. When he was given a mug of calf, he sipped at it with evident satisfaction. Straker had the odd impression the fellow considered himself unrestrained. He certainly didn't act like a prisoner. He wasn't defiant, he wasn't subservient, he simply was. "I'm Derek Straker," he said. "They call me the Liberator. Who are you?"
"My designation is Myrmidon. You can call me Don, if you like."
The man's voice seemed very ordinary, with an earthen accent hard to place. "You claim to be an Opter, but you look human?"
"As do you, Liberator. Though you're almost as far from the original human stock as I. It appears you've been infused with Opter biotech."
Straker sat back in mild puzzlement. "Not quite. I was infected with the Hawk parasite, but I took the antidote before it ran its course."
"And where do you think the mutuality obtained the Hawk parasite?"
Straker's mind reeled. Zaxby, Nolan, and Indy all tried to speak at once, demonstrating that they weren't quite as integrated as Straker believed. Zaxby won out by dint of throwing himself into the seat next to the prisoner and talking to him from a range of centimeters.
"I knew it. I knew the mutuality's demonstrated biological expertise was insufficient to create something like the Hawk. Otherwise, there would not only be Hawk, but all sorts of other biotech options for its citizens, such as rejuvenation or physical alterations for unusual environments or—"
Straker interrupted loudly, reaching to shove Zaxby aside. "Pardon the annoying squid brainiac, Mr. Myrmidon. So Opter Biotech made the Hawk? Why?"
"Call me Don, please." "Because the mutuality was losing to the 100 worlds at the time. The Sarmak faction gave them the biotech to balance the scales, disguised as a natural discovery on a newly explored planet. It was untraceable to the Opters, and of course the Mutuality Party oligarchs embraced anything that gave them greater control over their own citizenry, as any government naturally would."
"Yes, it's a win-win for people like that," Straker said, eyes unfocused. "If a citizen couldn't be re-educated, he'd be turned into a Hawk battle slave." He folded his hands and placed his elbows on the table, leaning forward to focus on Myrmidon, or Don, as he seemed to want to be called. "And the Opters did this to keep the Huns from winning?"
"Yes."
Straker thought about this for a moment.
"How long have Opters been interfering in human affairs, encouraging them to fight each other, balancing the scales, as you say?"
He snapped his fingers.
"And the nectar? That's just one more way of screwing with us, I bet. How long?"
"For centuries."
"Why?"
"I believe you already know the answer."
"I could guess."
Zaxby opened his mouth, but Straker nodded to Nolan. Maybe letting the woman speak for Trinity would curb some of Zaxby's verbal outbursts.
"Can you?"
Nolan's pale green eyes blinked.
"To keep humanity weak and busy fighting itself."
She turned to Don.
"Only it didn't work as expected, did it?"
"Not in the long run, no. Every gift to one side or the other, every convenient, well-timed breakthrough, and there were many, restored the balance. But the tension between the two human sides kept military technology advancing. If not for the failure of the promise of AI, the progress curve would have turned exponential, as was expected hundreds of years ago. However, this technological singularity never occurred. Instead, humans kept breeding and spreading from world to world. Opters and other species couldn't compete. It was a dilemma."
"So what changed after so long?" asked Straker. "Why attack us now?" Don stared and blinked at Straker. His eyebrows rose slightly.
After a long moment, Straker got it. Me. Or at least, the Liberation. I've upset the balance. We have a real shot at unifying humanity now, and you Opters can't stand that idea.
Not all Opters. The Sarmak faction.
What's this Sarmak faction?
There are two major factions within our species. The Sarmak is dominant, but not all-powerful, composing approximately 5/6 of our people. They border human space. The Miskor is the other faction. They are located on the other side of Opter territory.
And you're one of those Miskors?
Said Nolan, approaching Myrmidon to lay a hand on his shoulder. The man, if such he were, seemed to take no notice of the touch, and spoke.
I am Miskor. I've been embedded for years among the Sarmak, gathering information.
So you're an internal spy, said Straker. An operative.
I am.
Then how can we trust you?
I don't expect you to. I expect you to verify everything I say. Without my information, though, you're likely to make grave missteps.
I don't think you wish to court a general war with the Opters. You don't call this battle the start of a serious war? Myrmidon smiled faintly.
This was an independent raid, tactically approved by the Sarmak and conducted by some of the most belligerent nests. If justification is ever needed, it will be claimed either that these nests acted as rogues, or that they were attempting to aid the legitimate mutuality government against the Liberation rebels.
Fake reports, propaganda, lies, and politics, Straker spat. I hate politics.
But you're a warrior, and war is politics by other means. Across the galaxy, life's base impulse is to spread and grow and ruthlessly dominate its neighbors to its own benefit.
That sounds like a miserable view of things.
It is, Don said. Though I said this is life's base impulse. With sentience comes morality, which regulates the ruthlessness of the jungle. A sufficiently advanced species will endeavor to think honestly and act morally.
That doesn't describe most species I know.
Precisely. While enlightenment is a goal, it's also a journey.
Straker snorted. Now you're talking in cryptic mumbo-jumbo like my Kung Ju instructors.
Do you have writing materials?
Don asked. Zaxby reached into a drawer and retrieved a pad and stylus, activating its analog graphics feature before placing it in front of Myrmidon. The Opter man scribbled with the stylus for a moment, and then turned it to show Straker a list of mathematical equations. Yeah, so?
To you, that's cryptic mumbo-jumbo. But to this Ruxin here, whom I perceive to be a technician or scientist, it is
a rather elegant proof of Rizzo's fifth theorem, Zaxby cried, seizing the pad in three tentacles and holding it as if precious. It's not the first proof I've seen, but it is undoubtedly the most elegant. I must record this and distribute it to my network of Ruxin colleagues.
Straker crossed his arms. Great. Point made. You have to know things to know more things. But you also have to translate your obscure higher principles into actions that help people in the real world. That's what I'm doing. I'm liberating people from oppression. I can't tell them how to live after that. In fact, I don't want to keep intervening unless they start up with the oppression and subjugation again. Don folded his hands again.
That's a fine goal. But even if you succeed in the short term, you'll only be putting out fires.
Then the fires will be out. Call me a fireman. I know my strengths and weaknesses. I'm not a builder or a ruler.
What if you could be more than you are?
Straker shrugged. What if I don't want to be?
Then there'd be nothing more to be said on the subject.
Fine. Straker stood. Trinity, debrief him fully. Verify as much of his story as you can and then turn him over to Fleet Intelligence for further interrogation. Don stood as well.
I'll provide all the information I can, but sending me to rot in some think tank is an unwise use of my skills.
I'll be the judge of that. Straker nodded at Nolan and she followed as the robot marched the chained man-thing out of the room toward the ship's tiny brig. He turned to Zaxby. What do you think?
He seems to be as human as you are. Indy has a full suite of biometric sensors on him and could sense no deception. However, we don't know his capabilities. Perhaps he could lie and show no sign.
He seems sincere. And what he said about meddling with humans is plausible, obvious even in hindsight. Zaxby blinked all four eyes in sequence.
It may also explain my own people's subjugation by humans.
You weren't any more subjugated than humans were to other humans.
It may seem so to you. You never had to deal with the bullying, the taunts, the mean-spirited abuse from your adolescent fellow cadets at Academy, who knew they would never be as capable.
Straker snorted. Oh, yes, I did take that crap. Many times. They knew I was destined to be a top mech suitor, and some resented it. But I bet you brought a lot of it on yourself by acting superior and snooty.
I am superior.
And snooty. But people don't like their noses rubbed in it.
Fortunately, I have no nose.
But they do. Why don't you think with some of your Trinity brain for a while and try to see things from other points of view? I'm sure Miss Nolan has a lot of insight into humans.
That's a good idea. I am constantly amazed by your lack of stupidity, Derek Straker.
And I'm constantly amazed that even brain-linked to an AI and a human, you haven't improved your people's skills.
Thank you,
Zaxby said primly.
That wasn't a compliment. I believe it was. It's also ironic, coming from you. I never heard anyone laud your people's skills.
Straker sighed. Forget it. I'm totally beat. Gonna catch a nap. Hold any comm links, wake me up in 3 hours, and I'll read the debrief. Later, fresh mug of calf in hand, Straker read over the written summary of the defector's debrief, and then read it again. It appeared Myrmidon's story checked out, as far as Trinity could tell. More interesting, he'd provided an enormous amount of useful intelligence on Opter territory, technology, and weaponry. Everything Straker saw worried him. He carried the hand tab and mug to the brig. The door unlocked and opened with a push of his elbow. Of course, Trinity controlled everything aboard her body, or Indy did, whatever. He couldn't figure out where one began and the other ended. Inside, he sat facing Don, who still wore his chains like jewelry rather than shackles. I'm amazed at this windfall of intel, Straker said, holding up his hand tab. What made you decide to betray your people?
I am not betraying my people. I'm attempting to restore balance. Opters revere balance, elevating it to a spiritual significance. Like many revered spiritual values, however, it's often sacrificed by those greedy for gain.
So you're acting for the greater good, I understand that. I'm thinking about doing some things that my old chain of command of the 100 worlds would consider treasonous, though I deem them to be for the greater good. Yet, giving us all this intel could lose a lot of Opter lives.
Myrmidon shrugged. Opter nests don't hold the lives of individual members in high regard. Losing warriors, workers, or technicians is analogous to a corporation losing machinery. The nest is the valued entity, not the member.
I guessed that from your tactics, but you might lose whole nests if it comes to war.
We may.
Straker tossed the hand tab on the table, rubbed his jaw, and thought. But since you're Miskor from the underdog faction, you don't necessarily mind if the Sarmak takes some hits. It will bring things closer to the balance you like.
Very astute. That's one consideration.
What's another?
We believe the current Sarmak intentions to be immoral, intended to subjugate or, if necessary, wipe out the majority of your species.
We? The Miskor?
Yes.
Straker sighed. This is all pretty convenient, this story you've told me. It's plausible, it's consistent, and it's seductive. I want to believe it. but it could also be a complete illusion, a setup and a scam intended to get me and the new Earthen Republic to act a certain way. Don spread his hands to barely less than the limits of his chains.
You'll have to decide for yourself.
Oh, I will. But here's another question. Why are you so smooth? Why aren't you like other aliens? Even someone like Zaxby, who's been around humans much of his life, doesn't act like one. Nobody would ever guess you're an Opter. The Opter man took a deep breath and sighed.
I suppose it's because I've been studying the human worlds all my life. I've lived among you off and on for years, immersed in your civilization. Culture matters more than the body or its appearance. Opters can use biotech to reshape bodies at will, which renders the body largely irrelevant as a marker of identity. In every way that matters, I am human.
Straker pointed a finger at Don.
That's exactly what I mean. Smooth. You got an answer for everything, and that's what bothers me. In fact, the one flaw in your perfect humanity is that you're too perfect, too stereotypically human, because real people are never as poised and perfect as you are. But con men are.
Myrmidon shrugged.
A catch-22, then. If I made mistakes, you'd see them as evidence of deception or untruth. If I don't, you see that fact as evidence of deception or untruth. Damned if I do, damned if I don't.
Another perfect answer.
That's how you perceive it.
I am a more advanced soul than you are.
Don said this without a hint of smugness, as if merely stating a fact.
Straker's answer dripped sarcasm. Oh, really?
Yes. Just as you're above a recruit at boot camp. The recruit doesn't even know what he doesn't know, and at first must be convinced of his fundamental ignorance.
True wisdom is to know you know nothing. Straker rubbed an eye and sipped his cooling calf.
Socrates, among others.
But I always thought that was bullshit. I know what I know, and it ain't nothing.
But you have no inkling of what you don't know. For example, you not only didn't know the Opters were an enemy, you didn't even know Opters existed until recently. Nor did you know you should care, and how they influenced your life. One key to success is to expect to be surprised at all times.
If you expect to be surprised, you can't be surprised. Okay, fair enough, but how does that get us anywhere now? How can I trust what you say?
Seeing is believing.
Meaning what?
I can take you to the Opter space. You can walk among us, as I do.
Straker's eyes widened. What? They're gonna let a human just roam around?
You still misperceive. No, they will not let a human roam around, but they will let an Opter do so. I am Opter. The bipedal form of human I wear is of little relevance. Bipeds have been incorporated into the nests and hives over the last few centuries, just as the workers and warriors and other specialized facets were over the preceding millennia.
Myrmidon smiled.
If we can turn humans into hawk in the space of days, we can certainly turn them into opters. And breed our own.
Straker shuddered involuntarily at the horror of a biotech that would steal people's humanity. He'd gotten used to the idea of the hawk, but only by ignoring its deeper implications. Now he had to face those implications. Even more than the threat of conquest, these opters could corrupt and change what made people human, what made him human, what made Straker himself. Were those the same thing, though?
Trinity, you listening?
Straker asked.
I am.
Send out a message to your Brainiac network, all the labs and biologists and so on. Get working on the vaccine, something to protect people from Hawk and Opter biotech. If we already have one, make sure it gets distributed and that people are vaccinated.
That will be an enormous undertaking across 1,000 systems. A matter of years.
Then the sooner it gets started, the better.
I will pass the message.
Trinity's voice seemed to express doubt, but Straker didn't care. His job was to get people to do what needed to be done, not tell them how to do it.
That's a wise precaution. But the Sarmak can create endless new strains that will get around any vaccine, said Myrmidon.
Move and counter-move. It will be a biological war. Don't forget, we humans have engineered some pretty nasty diseases ourselves. We've wiped out whole species of bugs on our planets.
Myrmidon raised a palm slightly. You don't need to convince me. I'm working toward peace and balance.
Too bad that usually means fighting a war first.
You mouth platitudes of peace, Liberator, but you love war.
Straker's eyes narrowed, but he considered before answering.
Part of me does. I was bred to be a weapon, genetically enhanced for it. Everybody likes to do something they're good at. I bet you love this secret agent stuff, even if you claim you wish it weren't needed. But we're both smart enough to look past what personally gives us our hard-ons and work for the greater good, right?
Right.
Then let's go.
Myrmidon raised his eyebrows.
Go?
To your people. I need to see for myself, that's what you said.
I have an Opter ship hidden among the asteroids. It's stealthy and side-space capable.
Will your ship hold too? Straker asked.
It will.
How long is the trip?
At least 12 days each way. And you should plan for a few weeks of observation.
So call it 2 months minimum, Straker stood. Does it matter what I bring along?
No. I'll provide all you need.
Then I'll meet you at the airlock in 1 hour.
Chapter 5 Engels, 3 days later, New Earth. Commodore Carla Engels sat at the head of the Indomitable's main conference room surrounded by fellow officers, ship captains, squadron commanders, aides, and even admirals of the former Mutuality, now Earthen Republic, Navy. Yet she felt alone. Well, except for the aides. Those aides, mostly Ruxins and humans, but also two elephant-trunked Hufflor, a lizard-like Suslin, and even a Thorian wrapped in his rad suit, were present in the flesh. The others were holograms, but the only proof of this was their lack of substance. Their hollow vid and audio were flawless. Engels, seeing Indomitable's inability to reassemble in time and reach the battle at the Murmorsk inner worlds of M3 and M4, had decided to keep the battleship separated and ready for transit. When she'd been unable to sway Straker from his insanely hazardous course to visit Opter Space in person, when had she ever been able to talk him out of anything, she ordered Commodore Gray and the fleet back to New Earth, formerly Unison. Now Indomitable hung in orbit above the New Earthen capital, the rest of the fleet within easy transmission range. After a quick consultation with retired Admiral Bonota, Minister of War, she ordered this meeting to assemble. Yes, ordered. Never mind that she had no genuine statutory authority to do so. She was just a jumped-up ship captain, and all she really had going for her was her status as the Liberator's wife, good right hand, and space tactician. But she and Bonota had a plan for that. And if Straker didn't like it, well, that was too damned bad. Running off for 2 or 3 months meant he didn't get a say. Engels rapped a gavel on the table, and the holographic conferencing system transmitted the action flawlessly to every other location in the secure network where the attendees sat.
I call this Council of War to order, she said as the chatter died. I yield the floor to Minister Bonota.
Thank you, Commodore. Our first order of business is settling the chain of command.
The large, florid man, now dressed in a simple civilian suit, glanced at a row of more than 30 admirals and generals, formerly of the Mutuality. They'd had many days to think about their status, bureaucratically frozen by the new Senate's reorganization edicts, and where they would end up in the new regime. If there was resistance, now was when it would manifest. Bonota continued.
Right now, all of you flag officers have your positions, your staffs, your privileges, and your pensions, according to the edicts. Before I continue, does anyone wish to retire at your current rank and grade? If so, simply indicate that fact and leave this meeting. You'll be a private citizen within weeks. No? Last chance, ladies and gentlemen? Nobody moved. All right. Let it be on your own heads, then. Benota picked up a hard copy folder. I have here the new flag staff table of organization, confirmed by the Senate. All but the following three of you are mandatorily retired at the grade of Flag 1, regardless of former rank. Devereaux, Capuchin, Lubang. The rest will be processed out immediately. Benota waited for the howls of protest to subside. You will note in your copy that you may appeal this action through the usual channels. Thank you, and goodbye. All but the three designated flag officers winked out, disconnected from the Hololink. Good riddance, Benota muttered.
Will they cause trouble? Asked Commodore Gray, sitting to Engels's right.
I knew they wouldn't volunteer to retire, so I gave the HOC in their offices specific instructions to immediately distribute my orders in writing to all the staff. They'll escort them off the premises and revoke their security clearances and access.
He smiled a wintry smile.
I'd like to see them start trouble.
Seems a bit high-handed, Gray replied. Benota waved airily.
I am but a humble servant of the duly elected Senate, carrying out their orders. Don't worry, Commodore, or should I say, Admiral Gray. It's all legal.
Gray lifted a dark eyebrow.
Admiral?
Yes, in charge of the new home fleet. Does that suit you?
Gray glanced at Engels, who grinned.
I nominated you. Think you can handle it?
I can.
Good. But what about you, Commodore?
Gray asked. Engels turned to Benota.
Yes, Wen, what about me?
Benota made a production of looking in the folder.
Ah, yes, here it is. Given that you're the Liberator's wife, we couldn't very well...
Screw that, Minister, Engels snapped, playing her part. I've earned my place on my own. My relationship to Derek Straker is a separate issue. What's the will of the Senate?
She held her breath, waiting to see if Benota would follow through on what he agreed, or if the Senate had allowed him to.
How does Fleet Admiral sound?
Benota said. Genuinely surprised, she smiled.
What's that mean?
It means you'll be the senior operational naval officer in the Republic, top dog in the field.
Woof!
Engels forced herself not to gape. She'd expected a big promotion, but to give her the whole fleet. She shook herself and straightened.
Okay, I accept. But will the rest of the chain of command?
For now, the HOC follow the Senate's orders through me. We're at war under martial law, and I'm the Minister of War.
Engels's eyes narrowed in suspicion. Was her promotion some kind of payoff to get her to go along?
Quis custodiet ipsos custodes?
Latin?
Who watches the watchers? She said. What keeps you from being a dictator?
Benota spread his hands.
The same thing that conquered the mutuality. You, Indomitable, and the rest of your military forces. Commander Poloko and the Breakers are here in the capital, not to mention your marines and your ships above us. The HOC are compliant to my orders, but there are nowhere near enough of them to actually enforce my will on more than this one planet. The rest of our brave new republic has to be itself legitimately governed. I suggest that unless you want to go running from planet to planet with that battleship, threatening to bomb everyone back to the Stone Age, you have to trust me to knock the heads and herd the cats, while you worry about our next big problem.
Which is?
The Hundred Worlds.
They're gobbling up our systems as fast as they can, while we're barely able to defend our committee worlds, our central worlds, I mean, from this new Opter threat. We need to work fast to raise new forces and plan for a war on two fronts if necessary. Bonota scowled. Liberation won't mean much if all Straker did was set us up to be conquered by the Huns and the Bugs.
The Huns haven't responded to our overtures for a truce and talks?
They're stalling while they grab more territory, and frankly our local forces aren't fighting all that hard. They feel off balance and defeated by the liberation anyway. The Huns don't look so bad.
Engels scowled and bared her teeth. I'd have thought they'd be overjoyed to get out from under the Inquisitors and want to defend their newfound freedom.
The border worlds have been fought over so much the people are war-weary. With the fear of repression gone, many of them actually want the Huns to come in with their big money and their entertainments. Or that's what they hope. They see the propaganda broadcasts that make the 100 worlds look like a consumerist paradise. Bonota sighed. That's always been the mutuality's dilemma. Patriotism goes only so far in the face of perpetual misery and fear. The citizenry's spirit has collapsed. I'm afraid our brand new republic may collapse with it, especially with the Liberator off on this reconnaissance mission.
Engels held back a sharp retort. Bonota was right, damn him, on every point. The only silver lining to this storm cloud was the fact that the new republic was just so damned big. Even if the 100 worlds gobbled up 100 more, the old mutuality still had 1,000 systems to draw from. She was beginning to see why the war lasted so long.
We can't help where Straker chooses to go and for how long, so let's get past that and do what needs doing, she said. Distro the rest of that reorg plan, if you please, Minister. We'll reconvene in an hour to discuss operations.
Operations?
As you said, we have to fight the 100 worlds. With Straker gone, I'm the Supreme Field Commander, and I intend to give the Huns a punch in the nose that will bring them to their senses.
Display Calypso system and zoom in on C-1, the first planet, Admiral Engels said when the holo conference resumed. The table lit up with a detailed depiction of an unusual star system. A curved streamer of dense gas, millions of kilometers long, reached out from the primary, a small orange sun. At its end, it thickened into a ball. The ball had at its core a supermassive gas giant, which was slowly eating the plasma the star fed it. At some point in the last few million years, the planet had swung close to the star, and its gravity had plucked at its corona like a child unrolling a skein of cotton candy. Soon enough, perhaps within only a few 100,000 years, the gas eater would gain enough mass to ignite into a star of its own. Within the nimbus of swirling gas around the planet hung a gargantuan orbital fuel processing facility, by far the largest ever built, covering a captured asteroid moonlet over 100 kilometers across.
Felicity Station, Engels said. No other fuel factory is as big or as efficient, because nowhere else do we find this concentration of rich gas just floating in space. Easy access to a variety of hydrogen isotopes and byproducts. It supplies half the Republican military with high-grade fuel and exotic elements, and it refines the thickest known stream of antimatter anywhere. They collect over 10 kilograms a year there, one atom at a time.
Admiral Gray whistled.
That would make one hell of a bomb.
That would be wasteful, said Zaxby, who was running the holo table. Antimatter has many useful qualities for research and engineering. Destroying it to obtain an explosion that could just as well be generated by a fusion device would be foolish.
Like using diamonds for bullets, Engels agreed. The point is, this is a valuable facility and it's in the path of the Huns' advance. They've been methodically absorbing systems so far, playing it safe by taking and securing each in turn rather than striking deep into our territory, so I'm confident in the timeline of our arrival, plus or minus a few days.
Captain Jolin, now assigned as commander of the super-dreadnought Stuttgart, spoke up.
So we meet them there and stop their advance, at least along that axis. But I've been studying the intelligence reports. There are 19 separate Hun fleets, each taking a system every few days or weeks. Turning them back at one place won't solve the problem.
I don't intend to turn them back, Captain Jolin. Engels smacked her fist into her palm. I intend to crush them. I haven't trained for war my whole life just to play interstellar chess with fleets, a game we're losing.
Admiral Gray raised her eyebrows.
Now you're sounding like Straker. I learned from his wins and his mistakes. This isn't the liberation when we're trying to incite people to rebellion and get them on our side. This is straight-up war, and we have to press our few advantages.
What advantages?
Indomitable, for one. Two, our certainty they will strike Felicity Station at Calypso. Three, the time we have to prepare. It's our home ground, and they'll be operating at the end of their supply lines.
Engels sighed.
I once thought the Hundred Worlds was always the pious defender and would make peace when the opportunity presented itself. But our new senates sent a dozen official messages to their parliament and received no response but continued conquest.
It's hard to get people to talk when they think they can win by force, said Benota.
The Ruxin war male Dexon stirred his tentacles.
War is politics by other means, the human Karl von Clausewitz said. He also said the target of our efforts must be the enemy's will to fight. This is why the liberation was successful. We broke the mutuality's will, even while a thousand worlds remained militarily untouched.
That's right, Commodore Dexon, Engels replied. And I intend to conduct some violent politics in order to target the Huns' will to fight. Ladies and gentlemen, please clear the room of all but flag officers.
Zaxby stood as if to go, but Engels waved him down.
Not you.
So I'm a flag officer?
Engels humphed.
Trinity is unique. Let's call you a special advisor to the Admiral of the Fleet, if you want the job.
We would be honored.
Well,
he said hastily, I'm not, but Marissa is, and Indy seems impressed, though she is young. I, however, have worked with many admirals and am not easily dazzled by rank and status.
And to think I was worried your annoying individuality could possibly be drowned in a group mind.
Engels deadpanned.
Zaxby, run that sim of my plan, would you?
When Engels presented her plan, the room fell silent. The senior officers seemed to ponder. Or maybe, she thought, she'd shocked them. Their sudden protests confirmed it. Even the usually phlegmatic Benota had opened his mouth, though he'd shut it again with a grimace as others babbled. Engels stood and waved them to silence.
Don't try to tell me it can't be done. Tell me the problems, and then tell me how to solve them. Who first?
That slowed them down. They all looked at each other as if deciding who would be the naysayer. Zaxby's tentacles seemed to twitch, and then grow still. Engels wondered if that was the other parts of Trinity overriding his natural chattiness.
Zaxby, you have something, Trinity?
We have read a detailed analysis of your plan, Admiral Engels, and can present it at this time.
You can work with the staff on the details later. For now, what's the top problem and its solution?
Obviously, ships, especially escorts, destroyers, frigates, and corvettes. The battle with the Opters, though a victory of sorts, was costly. Over 100 escort ships destroyed and 200 more damaged. Over 9,000 trained crew killed.
But we didn't lose any capital ships.
That is fortunate, but that has only exacerbated the divide between the neglected and overburdened escort classes.
Zaxby turned to Marissa Nolan, who rose from her seat among the now absent staffers.
Doctor?
The slender, ethereally pale woman stepped forward. Morale among our naval escort corps is on the verge of collapse. The mutuality treated their personnel badly, used them as a dumping ground for problems, and assigned them every dirty job, such as military suppression of dissent. Combined with overwork
and lack of maintenance. We might as well say that as a fighting force, they're now non-existent. They gave the last full measure against the Opters, yet there's no relief in sight.
We should rotate personnel from the capital ships and the reserves, said Admiral Gray. Set up recruitment and training, raise pay and bonuses.
That takes money, replied Minister Bonota dryly. Our new Senate is already agitating for tax